Hello, and thanks for listening to this episode of Time with a Creative Mind. We're meeting today with Andrew Krivak, author of A Long Retreat in Search of a Religious Life, a memoir about his 8 years in the Jesuit order and his decision to leave that order. Andrew's also editor of the letters of William Carlos Williams to Edgar Irving Williams, 1902 to 1912. This work emerged out of his doctoral work, which he completed here at Rutgers University. Andrew is also a published poet and a novelist. Indeed, his novel, The Sojourn, has been hailed as the best World War I novel since All Quiet on the Western Front, and was nominated for the National Book Award in 2011. Andrew is the son of Slovak immigrants, and he grew up in Pennsylvania, has lived in London, and has taught at Harvard, Boston College, and the College of the Holy Cross. Andrew's also a graduate of St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland, the Great Book School, which is where we met. A fellow alum asked me, after hearing about Andrew's success across all these different writing genres, if there was anything Andrew couldn't do. I suggested that she look at Andrew's author photo, and there she would see that Andrew apparently is not able to age. I hope you enjoy this conversation, which comes from our meeting in 2009. Thank you.
I'm Richard Millich of the English department, and I'm very happy to welcome Andrew Krivak back to campus. Andrew's a graduate from our PhD program, and I've known AGA since 1980, so 1981, so that's a long time. This is a beautifully written book, A Long Retreat, which is Andrew's memoir of his experiences training to join the Catholic Church as a priest. My experience reading this book is not going to be the common experience because I've known him for so long. And yet, actually, there's just this big chunk where he and I fell out of contact, which this book then represents that whole adventure. So we went to college together. Well, a little bit, overlapped a little bit.
1 year. Richard was my RA when I was a freshman. He was a senior.
Wow.
AJ and I got back in touch just as Andrew was moving into the Bronx to do work for the Catholic Church.
So as I was moving from the period of formation as a Jesuit scholastic, so I was a member of the Society of Jesus and the Jesuits, and after my period of philosophy studies, you then move on to teach, and so I did those studies at Fordham. And was about to go to Le Moyne College to teach philosophy. And these are all, it's all laid out in the book, but essentially it's it was the time when I was doing some summer work in the Bronx, and was back in touch with Richard here in New Jersey, and so he had a trip down one July evening, I think.
Yeah, and you know, I was just suddenly, not raised as a Catholic, just sort of plunged into this radically, for me, radically different world, and radical transformation from writing poetry and talking about ideas and playing basketball to Andrew's having embarked upon this profoundly demanding and what you call in here countercultural, which is just a fascinating spin on counterculture, it seems to me, that to talk about taking the vows and this spiritual journey.
I guess throughout my formation as a young boy in northeastern Pennsylvania and having my parents throw books at me, something about doing something different other than staying at home and you know, working in a grocery store just always propelled me. And so I think that's just always been part of not only my temperament but my desire. And so the desire to study, to do philosophy, that seemed strange at a time.
Yeah.
My brother himself, my older brother used to say to me, you know, why are you wasting the old man's money studying philosophy? But my parents said, look, you do what you want to do. Luckily, my parents were well educated, and said, go wherever you want, if there are books involved, and we'll do what we can for you. But the priesthood was another thing, and I think, you know, being raised in a family of seven kids as a Catholic, and a happy Catholic, you know, in East, when you come from an Eastern European tradition, Catholicism comes with a lot of really good food. So church was great. It wasn't a hardship. The priest was a great guy. The priest was something of a frustrated philosopher himself, I think, and did what he could in this small parish in Dallas, Pennsylvania to eke out a life of work and prayer for himself. But what I get at it here is, so after St. John's College, I moved to Cape Cod to work on boats because, as Richard knows, you just do all that studying and reading, and it might have been a bit of guilt because of the fact that my brothers did work with their hands. I wanted to be able to say, yeah, I know how to do that. And so I had this great job as a yacht rigger, and when you're in that environment, you meet people and who need work done, and so I met a few captains, and one guy asked me to help him deliver his sailboat. He was a paid captain. And the owner had this big 85-footer, and I flew down to Nassau, and the four of us who sailed it for 8 days up to the boatyard in Cape Cod. And I thought for a while that, gosh, you know, if all I have to do is another one of these, I can sit for my captain's license and I can do this. But it's a lonely, transient experience. And in the accumulation of, let's say, places, books, ideas, desires, it just was so clear to me that that's not the kind of life I wanted to live. I wanted to make a difference in the world. And somehow, which is in the book, my ongoing place as a Catholic, I stuck to that search, and my own philosophical education and the desire to do something different all emerged with meeting some Jesuits in the South Bronx just as I was finishing my MFA at Columbia. And I realized that's what I want to do. I can pray and still work, because the Jesuits work and pray in the world, not like monks. They don't separate themselves to a monastery. They're in the world, doing social justice, teaching at universities, and saying, there's a great expression from John Courtney Murray, a theologian in the 60s, the Jesuit's job is to bring the world to the church and the church to the world. So that, I just love that idea. And so, set out. Maybe I should read this.
Yeah,
this
that'd be good.
Even though my memory is never far from a composition of that time and place, Saturday the 25th of August, the skies, at least for an hour or two, a rare blue, with a nudging breeze on which wafts the brewed smell of an early autumn. The sun feels warm but weakening. Inside a high-ceilinged, stained-glass-lit modern sanctum of the Jesuit residence on the campus of Le Moyne College in Syracuse, the chapel of St. Andrew's Novitiate, too small to host everyone, the air is conditioned slightly toward a chill. A staggered collection of 13 young men dressed in khakis, polo shirts, and button-downs sit in a semicircle of chairs in front of a simple altar adorned with a white cloth. To five of the men belongs a smaller cadre of parents. A few middle-aged priests, dressed in their own street clothes, sweep into the room through swinging doors and join the company of worshippers. Another priest, wearing on this day a white stole of the liturgical celebrant, sits in a larger chair facing this congregation and stands when everyone has settled. Welcome, he says. An entrance hymn is held up on the confident voices of those who are at home here. The penitential rite at the beginning of the Mass feels, as it should, consoling. The readings are taken not from Sunday, but from Saturday, the 20th week in ordinary time, the gospel for which is Matthew 23, verses 1 to 12. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted. And then Father Don Gannon, S.J., Master of Novices in the New York province of the Society of Jesus, waits as we all sit back down again to begin speaking to us as a tribal father might to his many sons who have gathered to begin religious life as Jesuits at a time when a first-year class of five is considered a respectable number of vocations. The eight remaining in the second year suggests something of a boon. Having seen them come and having seen them go for nearly 6 years as superior of a house of formation, Father Gannon, in the unshakable attitude of the forgiven, says, some of you will leave this community after having joined it today. He means this to be neither insight into a betrayal nor a taunt, but a fact of religious life in the present and of the past. For the earliest Jesuits knew this too in 16th century Spain, France, and Portugal. I watch some of the mothers shift in their seats and fidget slightly, perhaps conscious for the first time that the odds are against their sons ever being ordained priests, regardless of how hard they've prayed. And I realize myself that after having arrived in Syracuse this morning on emotional autopilot, not knowing how to respond to the enormity of this day, I suddenly feel as though a challenge has been thrown down before me. 1 year ago, odds were I wouldn't have made it this far, an internal voice responds, as though wanting to vent its own tough, screw the odds, I'm staying attempt to pray. Then, as if you can hear a fugue-like variation of that same prayer in each one of our heads, Father Gannon goes on to insist that the work of this Jesuit novitiate is to allow both the novice and the Society of Jesus to make a deeper discernment about the man and the men who surround him. Should the novice stay and take vows to remain in the order, it doesn't indicate spiritual success, for the journey that is religious life then becomes the journey of a lifetime, bringing with it failures beyond the imagination, yet those to which each one of us has been called by God. Should the novice leave and go back out into the world, it doesn't mean he has failed. A lifetime of journeys remains there, too. He's still called to discernment and discipleship, Father Gannon says, and who knows, that may mean a more difficult path. He, not you, not me, but surely one, if not all of us. Who then, I wonder, as I looked around at the other men who had traveled from New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey to gather in that place on that morning, if not me, who?
You know, there's so many striking things about the way you've elected to open the book. But partly it's, it lends itself to the kind of storytelling you're doing because there's so few characters, you know, that you point out that there are only five people in the entering class. And that from the beginning, you're pointing out the that we're a long way from the red and the black, right? Where these were the two choices, military or priesthood, and now there's this turn towards the priesthood rather than, you know, we live at a time in the efflorescence of spirituality, but that doesn't require this kind of commitment and training that you've embarked upon.
There was it's interesting too, because a section I read last night in another reading, I talk about the fact that it's 1986, and all of my classmates at St. John's College were flocking to Wall Street,
yeah.
You know, doing foreign exchange and banking, and there was money to be made in 86 prior to the crash in 87. So to go work at a boatyard, a lot of people were like, what's up with you? Anyway.
Yeah. The training itself requires these profound encounters with the self, and how the self gets nourished, and how the self can lead to nourishing others. And this story, I mean, in a funny way, I love the cover of this book, but the two things together suggest a withdrawal from the world, which I think actually the story isn't about at all.
That's
right? Right. You know, that in fact this is a moving inward precisely because the spiritual practice drives you out to work in the world. As you say, it's not being a monk, it's to work in the world. I think that's connected to the emotional autopilot, that it's a confrontation with that allows for a transformation in your engagement with the world.
Yeah, great question and great observation. I'm always hoping that some readers pick out these little things that it took about 4 years to write this book, and so I was really tying, the same time you're tying the bows of literary and other types of evaluations. And so the fact is, there was nothing autopilot-like about these 8 years, except for that day.
Yeah.
And you wake up on day two and you're like, where did that autopilot go?
Right, because you're on totally unfamiliar ground.
It's very
right?
stark. And the other thing too, you know, I mentioned the piety of the rosary, which I love then, but you know, I've never said the rosary since. No, it's not any bad thing, but there's a way in which religious life, and it's very, or you know, joining a religious order, especially like the Jesuits, where they do thrust you out into the world. And another chapter talks about how I got there, into that situation. But it was a way in which my faith is deepened because they taught me or gave me a very stark encounter with God, which stripped away all of those pieties. I'm sure as I get older, I'll bring some back. But those sort of things are being hewn as the story, hewn away as the story moves along. I didn't answer all your questions. There was something else about, yes, the retreat. There's a purposeful, and I hope not too obscure, doubleness of that. Of this
absolutely.
Notion of retreat,
yeah.
Because in fact, the Jesuits, the core spiritual formation of Ignatian spirituality is the 30-day spiritual exercises, which is referred to as the long retreat. So using the title of a long retreat, what I'm trying to get at is this notion of religious life is the task of a lifetime, should you want to go for it. And I don't even think that you have to be Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, or otherwise, that there is a way in which we struggle with what Charles Taylor, in his new book, A Secular Age, calls the fullness. You can choose atheism, but you're still finding a kind of fullness in other things. But for those people who believe, the belief isn't a naivete, it's an experience with fullness.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a play on the word religious. It's the adjective religious life. But once you enter religious life, you are a capital R, religious. And a long retreat is a way in which I found that moving out of the Jesuits taught me that this long retreat is in fact a deep engagement and ongoing task of a lifetime with the world, a God created and good world. There's nothing retreat like or monastic about it. And that's the life I've chosen to keep following, maintain, keep hammering away.
Having gotten about as close as you could get, you know, which makes, you know, I can't read this without thinking of Karen Armstrong's work and how radically different your story is from Karen Armstrong's encounter with becoming a nun and then dropping out, and that's actually a story of not being taken care of and
right,
so forth.
Exactly.
And she too then goes on to try and get an English PhD, by the way, right?
Yeah.
And that turns out to be a disaster as well, but that's a different story.
Your story there is better too.
Yes. Right, you finished, whereas she became a historic denial case there, actually.
Memoir, just by the way, curiously, in the publishing industry, I don't believe it did. It was a real sleeper until she wrote that book about God and Islam.
Yes.
And everyone went back and said, oh, wow, she wrote this book called Through the Narrow Gate.
Yes.
And then it, you know.
And then she wrote the second one called The
Spiral
Staircase. Yeah. But so, you know, I interestingly for me reading this, of course I've got St. Augustine and so forth surrounding me as I read this. But I also had Karen Armstrong, and I couldn't help moving back and forth between the way in which the genders, of course, drive the narratives in part, but also that simply the two of you have very different stories to tell about this engagement with this tradition, and that for you, you engage with it thoughtfully, and then something happens that makes it become clear to you that in fact you should step away. Do you want to talk about that, or?
Well, I'll try, because in some ways, writing the book was about that, and it's a great question, because now when I find myself responding to it on the other side, it's not that I don't know why. It's just that sort of it's done and I move on.
Yeah.
But let's couch it in terms of discernment, Jesuit discernment, and let me just say initially that within the context of the spiritual exercises, a very boiled down version of Loyola's exercises is that what you're doing is you're exercising your spiritual capacity to know that you are a God-created individual, and the whole purpose is to find a clear way towards doing what God's will is in this world. We're talking the 15th, 16th century here, in order that the next world is the salvation of your soul. And so, what's right for you? What is God willed for you to do in this world? That's a huge question. And I talk a lot about, you know, I took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Chastity, difficult vow. Poverty, difficult vow. But obedience is, in a sense, the most terrifying, I say in the book, because imagine someone telling you what it is you're going to do with your life, and you have to trust that that's God's will. And you just don't want to do it. And so there are times when I could say to myself, all right, I'll go ahead, I'll go there, I'll do that. But ultimately, I got to the point where I stopped. I stopped trusting in that person's discernment and thought, well, hang on a second. Maybe what the Jesuits have done is taught me to discern for myself. Now, I have to be careful to say that discernment is within the Jesuits and within any religious community is as much a communal discernment as well as a personal one. But over time, I just realized that there wasn't... Religious life was no longer the kind of community where I could be my creative, God-created self. Questions of, I use an epigraph from Augustine, late have I loved you, beauty so old and so new. In a lot of ways, the life ceased to be beautiful for me. And yet, I still felt as though there was more to do. I didn't want to stop being a Catholic. But I didn't find the community of men to be the place where I wanted to live my life. And I do talk about falling in love in the book. There's an overlap with that. But I'm also very careful, and was careful at the time, to single out the discernment not to be a Jesuit from the desire to be married or to have an ongoing relationship with the woman who's currently my wife of 8 years. But again, all these discernments are very complex. You can never really sort out, okay, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do that. I had a great spiritual director I actually quoted here who says, you can't do that. You got to grab it and look at it in all of its complexities because that's what you've been given. It's very hard. And I think one of the problems of people thinking about religion these days is they fail to accept the complexity of our human nature. Too much of it is either or. You're either this or you're that. You're either, it's either good or bad. Yeah, there's those either ors exist in the realm of morality. Don't murder. It's not a good thing, But part of the tradition of the Catholic Church is a kind of both and. Jesus is both God and man. Try to get your head around that one theologically. Or as Aquinas would say, we are both like God and absolutely not God. And these both ends continually come up in Catholic theology. So the complexity of discernment was very important to me. But eventually, I just decided I can't imagine that if I move on in this life, I will become the man that God has created me to be. And so I'm going to ask to leave. The Jesuits oddly gave me time to write, and I was working on poetry there, and they gave me venues for writing things. But at the same time, it wasn't what I was being asked to do, and I kept thinking more and more. I was like, well, I think I'd really like to do this. And I think if I'd stayed and been ordained, I'd probably be on the staff of America Magazine, or Jim Araki, who was here, probably done a PhD and teaching in some school, things like that. So I would have ironically been doing the things that I do now. There was a way in which that sense of creativity, that desire for beauty in my life, writing wasn't just an exercise, there was a way in which I wanted to fashion something outside of the bounds of the vow of obedience.
The spiritual journey that you're describing is one that's profoundly internal, profoundly personal, that it translates fairly readily to the secular model of that, which is come here, become a PhD student. Is there simply a formal relation, analogy between those two, and it's the appearance that they're similar, or are there genuine similarities between this kind of retreat and then what used to be called the life of the mind? I'm not so sure it's the life of the mind anymore, but you're much more recently through the process.
Well, I can't pretend to speak about academia in any sense.
But you can compare the training, right? Yeah. I mean, because you came through here and really in record time got, wrecked everything up and did your orals and passed and got through here.
They taught me everything I know. When we were graduate students at Fordham, we were taking four graduate courses for 3 years straight, and you had to do well, and you had to visit the sick at the hospital, and you had to pray an hour a day, and you had to wash the dishes. Well, everyone washed the dishes, but the Jesuits particularly are a good comparison for a higher education because they are engaged in higher education.
Absolutely.
So in a sense, they wrote the book on higher education.
Carrie?
I know I had talked to you a long time ago about the image of the bend in the river. And so when I saw the book with that, I wondered where that image came from, because, of course, to me, it makes the word retreat second meaning.
Yeah. Stand out.
Really stand out.
It does. Yeah.
That the long retreat, as you're talking about it, is a whole life of thinking about a relationship with God. And in a long retreat suggests moving away from something. And, in the priesthood, moving away from certain kind of engagement with the world, in terms of family, perhaps in terms of some of that. Is for you, is there any of that second meaning there, a retreat from the priesthood? Is that a long retreat for you? Is that a retreat that's difficult or slow or does that have some other meaning?
No, I think that's another, that's a great reading of the complexity of the title, which took a while for me and my editor to come to. But yes, in fact, part of what I hope is seen as well is the way in which, in the early part of the book, I really talk about the sort of the long time it took me to get to realize that abiding fervor in my heart was a desire to enter religious life. Mm-hmm. In fact, what emerges is that I needed to go through that in order to finally step away from this notion, this Catholic boyhood notion that you need to be a priest. I don't need to be a priest.
I would love for you to read another passage before we run out of time. I don't know.
I think that's a good idea.
Should I go on to read the other? I talk about the other four novices, and then I get to myself. Chris Polito is the most energetic and talkative of our class. He was from the Bronx, the North Bronx, and had been teaching history at a Catholic high school there. He was short with dark, tufty hair and beard, wore wire-rimmed glasses, and drew attention to the obvious fact that he was Italian, at times dropping into a Goodfellas accent for humor, appearing sure of himself and almost fearless. "So you're Andrew," he said to me. As we lingered in the novitiate refectory that morning, before we walked over to Lemoyne for Mass, "I read your bio. You spent the entire summer sailing?" I had forgotten about the short personal blurbs that had been printed in the Jesuits Company magazine, along with the photographs of all the new novices in the American Assistancy. I'd read the ones of the guys from New York, but I resisted memorization. I was helping out on a boat delivery from the Bahamas to Cape Cod. Delivering like on what, the ocean or a tractor trailer? On the ocean, 8 days, sometimes 100 miles out. Oh, I'd get sick or go crazy. I smiled, or both. I admired him, but there was something as well that made me resentful of his ease. You could be fearless and still be scared, like Faulkner's young man in there. When at some point I broke off from that conversation, Frank Evans stepped away from the group he was in, walked up to me and said in a conspiratorial tone, "I don't know about you, but I can only take so much of these family gatherings before I'll do anything for a beer." Jesus Christ. I started laughing as though both of us had been watching the entire day from a separate vantage point, and I started laughing with him from sheer relief and disbelief at his lack of piety. Frank was a tough, barrel-chested guy from Upper Montclair, New Jersey, who had that rare quality of always being able to summon respectful satire. It wasn't a mask so much as a criterion, for behind the humor and the healthy irreverence I would discover in time, he maintained a deep faith and a desire to express it. He had gone to Boston College and worked as a consultant in Manhattan, giving up a real career to join the Jesuits. His father had driven him to the novitiate that morning. His mother died sometime in the recent past. "All right," he said, "I'll be good. Let's go see what the guy who won't shut up is all about." Frank met Billy McGinnis, another one of us who stood close by our more sociable parents as though protecting them, or they us. Billy was an elevator repairman from Oceanside, Long Island. He had entered not to become a priest, but to be a brother, a man who takes vows in the Society of Jesus but chooses not to get ordained. A Jesuit brother's vocation is described as sharing, quote, "in the same religious commitment as the priests, one complementing the other, each serving the church." In the past, that meant they took their vows and got to work without any further education. These days, they were artists and physicists with PhDs. They taught in schools after they built them. At the time, though, brother or priest, it all seemed the same to me. I had heard that Billy was next to the youngest in our class and that he had chosen not to go to college. At 21, he had the stolid look of a man who knew physical work more intimately than he knew books or leisure. David McCallum, the youngest by a few months, was mingling with the second-year novices whom he clearly already knew. David was from Rochester and had just graduated from Lemoyne. Two priests teaching in the English department there had inspired him to think about life in the order so he made his way across the street enough times in his last 2 years of college to see what went on at St. Andrew's. It was clear from the start that the spiritual knight-errantry of St. Ignatius of Loyola and all of his followers since appealed to David's romantic and literary side. But he entered, he told me later, out of a desire for a spiritual freedom he couldn't define. David was on the universal path of that ancient struggle to know thyself. We all were, I suppose, but David's path was being paved by adversity. His decision to enter the Jesuits had not gone over well with his parents. He and his sister were their only children. Priesthood meant the family name would stop with their son, outgoing, intelligent, attractive with his Roman nose and slate eyes, and celibate. They loved the Jesuits they had met at Lemoyne, but you could see the awkwardness and disappointment on their faces that day. It said enough. Let some other mother's son do it. How can you place odds on a first impression of lives like these? And was I so sure I wouldn't be the first one to come and go from here once the reality of this adventure emerged and the ideal I had fomented in my imagination wore off? In some ways, it was a move lucid and right, as though I had returned home after a long time away. And yet I also couldn't shake the sense of being disoriented because I had decided to give up the idea of home for the rest of my life. Maybe the two were the same. I thought of my own drive here with my parents that morning, through Wilkes-Barre and Scranton and up into the endless mountains region, passing the sign on Interstate 81 for the town of Great Bend, where the Susquehanna River makes a full 180-degree turn, retreats north, wanders west toward its confluence with the Chemung, and threads its way south and east again through a labyrinth of dense and reclusive forest, until it arrives at the exact point to which it would have been drawn had it not been sent out into a wilderness. I could cross that bridge 100 times in one day and still feel as though the river had tricked me into believing I was suddenly moving in a new direction while I traveled steadily in the sea. I wasn't driving, though. My father was. It's what he always did when we needed him drive us from place to place, as though his vocation was to ferry others from one shore to another and let them get on their way. At 66, he was still a tall, handsome man with a sharp profile and a full shock of gray hair that over the years had passed from the look and texture of steel to cotton wool. Everybody loved Tom Krivak. Strong and exacting with his children, he was a bully and generous man toward anyone who considered him a friend. His father had died in a Wilkes-Barre coal mine at the age of 30. He was 3 and so never knew what it was like to feel a father's commanding presence, a presence every single one of his 7 children spent a lifetime under the aegis of. I loved him too. My mother, Irene, a petite woman with black hair and olive skin, perhaps giving away the presence of a distant outsider in the family generations ago, began her habitual rosary as my father drove and pondered my future that Saturday. She prayed not out of timidness or dread, and not because I was being delivered to a Catholic seminary, but out of her lifelong desire to transform everything she did into worship. No distractions, no noise. She craved a contemplative life that, like those of the desert suns, would never falter or cease. I often wondered how the ferryman and this mystic were partnered so well, but in the Greek of the church fathers, Irene means peace, that thing for which every traveler and anchorite longs. My mother's Marian devotion wasn't thoughtless piety. It was an invitation, as though a call, a reminder all of its own, of what remained important in our family, in our world. Anyone present was expected to respond. I can hear the rising and falling recitation that my parents and I uttered together as we crossed the border into New York State at a steady 65 miles per hour. I'd heard it moving along glass, wood, and stone beads my entire Catholic life, before daily mass in the mornings, after dinner in the months of October and May, at penitential intervals during Lent, and on the lips of great aunts and uncles sitting in their sorrow at a loved one's wake. It's an atonal, but heavily accented, dactyl-like profession of faith in Christ and the Virgin, as Hail Marys and Our Fathers stress one word over the elision or silence of others, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, an articulation in silence that would keep this man and woman bound to each other in the end for 53 years. At the age of 27, though, I turned elsewhere for my vows, my own sacred union. In 1986, after I graduated from the close and lettered world of St. John's College, Annapolis, I spent time as an ocean lifeguard, worked in boatyards, chipped away at a collection of poems, got accepted into a good graduate writing program, and went. I dated some interesting and attractive women and told them that I dreamed of sailing across the Atlantic and buying a house by the ocean. But a more fervid corner of my heart lay hidden, biding its time. I knew what I wanted to do. What I didn't know was how to go about it, whom to approach or where, though I trusted that these details would take care of themselves. Meanwhile, friends and classmates became bankers, lawyers, mathematicians, carpenters' wives. Eventually, the details fell into place, and the path appeared as I had pictured it, a disciplined, prayerful, and intellectually engaging community that wanted me to be part of it. Once I began to say that I was going to become a priest, it came as a shock, sometimes humorous, sometimes cautious, to everyone I knew, even those who were Catholic. A priest, they'd say, my God, what for? Father, what a waste. I thought you were smart. As we sat at the bar of Old Cannon's Pub after a poetry workshop in our last semester as graduate students at Columbia, my friend Greg slid Narcissus and Golden across to me. Read this, he said, in his habit of using as few words as possible, the book now among my favorites. The idea of becoming a priest, once as common sounding to me growing up a Catholic in rural Pennsylvania as the idea of becoming a fireman or a truck driver, suddenly sounded more uncommon than I realized. Only from my family was there no resistance. What seemed initially like indifference among my brothers and sisters, I realized later was their own insight into what kind of life I'd probably lead. I'm not surprised, was the answer I received from each of them, not because they considered me a freak or a misfit, but because they sensed that what I had been searching for this whole time. My parents, visibly pleased and yet respectful of my decision when I told them, seemed most of all to believe that I'd chosen a path deserving and lasting. More important, I was doing something that they could point to and be proud of, something that proved my intelligence and in some way offered more than I took from the world. He's a doer was the highest compliment my parents could pay a person, and I had finally decided what it was I wanted to do. For my part, I believed that I had, after years of running, stopped resisting the hound of heaven and turned in a direction that was meant for me. It's hard to explain what goes through the mind of a young man when he feels as though he's being called. The prophetic voice that's supposed to single out God's ordained to serve in this way, a Catholic male brought up to believe that priesthood is the noblest path a man can walk. Poverty, chastity, and obedience, so be it. Every man, every life demands sacrifice. What about freedom or a sense of adventure for the sailor and ex-lifeguard? What an adventure, a kind of exploratory team or foreign service for Christ. Something countercultural then from the boy who wanted and yet refused to belong. Could anyone have moved any further counterculturally in the late 1980s, when priests were being assassinated in El Salvador, monks decapitated in North Africa, and most Catholics had yet to line up politically with conservative evangelicals? And of all the orders, I had chosen to join the Jesuits. Perhaps I should say that they chose me, but like the brag of the English martyr Edmund Campion before he was hung, drawn, and quartered during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, I wanted to walk this path no matter what was required. Life and death, should it come to that, would mean something for me, and thereby I hoped for others. The expense is reckoned, Campion said. The enterprise has begun. It is of God. It cannot be withstood. Does all this sound strange to you? Is it because the very mention of priest now evokes as much suspicion as respect? Someone might say about my Catholic boyhood's innocence, my love for the church I grew up in, the priest I knew, he got lucky. But I would call it grace, something given that I never deserved. From the time I made my first Holy Communion at the age of 7 until I went away to college, I knew one man who wore the black cassock and white collar and who guided the souls of both professional and working class parishioners from within the graceful stone outline of St. Teresa's, Father Joseph Sammons. I never thought about it then, but it gradually became clear to me that he held our parish together with something more than duty, something more that strengthens faith and proves love, something that he alone understood and desired. Search for God every waking hour of the day through the holy dialectic of prayer and work. Once I could see this and understand it, I stopped wandering about and got started on that search for myself.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Time with the Creative Mind. I hope you'll check out the other podcasts in our series and that you'll drop us a line.